bang, 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 bangly bang. On the Empire Podcast this week, we talked to two superb British actors at very different stages of their career. One, George Mackay, is just starting out but has excellent work under his belt, including this week's Pride. And the other, well, let's just say, the name's Moore. So Roger Moore. That was a Roger Moore impression. Really good. Plus, this week's movie reviews and the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that, as a special treat, has taken a leaf out of U2's book and uploaded a Look Who's Talking Now spoiler special podcast into all your devices. No need to thank us. It's our gift to you. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by drumroll. Thank you. A Who's Line superfan who won't stand for any mockery if he mistakes. Oh, box. A Who's Line superfan who won't stand for any mockery if he makes a mistake. He just styles it out. It's Ali Plum.
Wayne to go.
Did you like that?
Yep.
I think Wayne I want to leave this pod and go work on a ranch somewhere.
That's a real...
Oh, that's good.
That's a real good. Mike McShane.
Oh, good stuff, guys. I love you guys. You're my favourite guys.
Wow, what a carry-on.
And gal, of course. Thanks. Speaking of gals, she's a supernatural super fan who, due to administrative oversights, managed to win Chester in a radio quiz. God knows what she'll do with it. It's Helen O'Hara.
Yes, I'm planning on turning the ancient walled city of Chester into a huge supernatural theme park.
As it should be.
Indeed.
Is it already?
Ha ha!
They're missing a trick, surely. Last but not least, it's a Jurassic Park superfan who's somehow still alive despite deciding to eat only food consumed in the movie. So he survives on a diet of Chilean sea bass, green jelly, and Samuel L. Jackson's arm. It's Nick Desemlian.
Right now, I'm squirting shaving foam onto a piece of pie and squashing it with my hand.
Have you ever consumed a live cow as it's been dropped down in top of you?
I don't like to talk about it.
Right.
What happens at Bodine's stays at Bodine's.
Excellent. Welcome all. Hope you're all well. I don't mean that. It's just to get the small talk out of the way. Here are some questions you guys have been sending in. Not you guys, the people in the booth with me, but you guys, the people who are not in the booth listening to this podcast. You sent in via Twitter this week. Here's the first question. It is from @Knittery, K-N-I-T-T-E-R-Y, who asks, what film shop would you most like to visit? By that, I presume they mean shops from movies and not, say, the cinema store, which is awesome. So, go on.
Well,
have it.
It's easy, actually. It's got to be Flourish and Blotts from Diagon Alley, Harry Potter, because it has magic books. And who doesn't want magic books?
I don't want magic books.
Well, you are a fool.
I have a Kindle.
Yeah, magicker than that, even.
What's more magic than a Kindle?
It seems impossible, and yet here we are. Also, Mr. McGorium's Wonder Emporium, for much the same reason, and also because it has a ridiculous name that deserves to be, you know, helped and supported.
Uh-huh.
And maybe the shop around the corner, because they had those interesting little boxes.
Yes. They do have interesting little boxes. I've just noticed as someone, the person who's been in this booth before us has left what can only be described as the contents of a donut on my desk, which is really frankly disgusting. But anyway,
I think Nedry's been here.
Nedry's been here. Ha ha ha.
Speaking of Nedry, I always wanted to go to the Jurassic Park merchandise, you know, when they had all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking how clever it was that in the movie they kind of took the mick out of merchandise. Like, look at all this vainglorious trumpeting of a theme park that wasn't even open yet, and then of course you go to the ride in Universal Studios and it's there and you do buy that stuff.
Hot fact, in the film the book that the camera pans past is the actual book you can buy, the making of the film, which I had. Very exciting. Look at that.
Oh. Twisting my melon. That's an incredible piece of meta.
That is amazing. I would love to go to Sven Jorgensen's Swedish bookstore as seen in Top Secret and see whether it really is backwards. Everything's backwards in that store.
Good,
including
call.
Sven Jorgensen himself. That's an amazing store I'd love to go to.
Hey, speaking of Scandinavian stores, you could also go to that winter clothing store in Frozen. That looked fun. They had a sauna in the back of the shop.
I still haven't seen Frozen.
You were a fool.
Okay.
Right. FAO Schwartz, obviously. I'll be the first one to say it, from Big, which I actually got a chance to visit last year.
Uh-huh.
I didn't go on the piano because I thought I'd look like a total Burke. But I should have. I'm regretting it now.
You spoke to Robert Loggia, didn't you?
Scarface.
Your Scarface feature. Did you mention the piano scene from Big to him?
It did not come up.
Great. That's an awesome anecdote.
I'd like to go to the quick stop from Clerks because it would be the least... Like, it could easily... Obviously, it is just still a store, I'm sure. But I like to think that people have no idea. They just go in, they buy the stuff, then it realises just how genuinely important this tiny store is. And more than that, the video store next door.
Yes.
If it's still around.
If video stores are still around. My God, yeah.
I've not been outside for 20 years, so I have no idea.
It's a rare breed, indeed.
I'm going to mention a shop. What about the pawn shop in Pulp Fiction? Wouldn't mind going to that.
No. What? Don't go there.
It's a lot of fun going on in there. I hear lots of noises. Yeah. It seems to be... a good time.
It's a fun time in the basement, I'm promised.
Yeah. Yep. There's a neon sign flashing going, downstairs for more fun. Chris, you look concerned.
You popped a store into my head and then immediately went back out again.
Well, I've got another one.
Okay.
Which is, this isn't a store in a film, but it is a store for a film. It is the Little Lebowski shop in New York, where someone has taken a very small shop and just turned it into a massive Lebowski fest. And you can see a small clip of Jeff Bridges going to this store, which, bear in mind, has inflatable dolls of every single character. One is strapped to the ceiling. You can probably guess why. She's about to spray paint all over the floor. And there's a video of Jeff Bridges on a PBS show called Jeff Bridges, The Dude Abides, walking into the shop and freaking out the owner, who's dressed in a dressing gown, wearing the shades. And he just goes, I, and just obviously just losing it. Mm-hmm. But of course, Jeff Bridges is the coolest cat and just goes, yeah, I like what you're doing. This is good. You got the mugs. Great. Yeah. And I can get a bowling pin bong. That's fantastic. So yeah, do check out that video. It's just a little quick teaser for a longer show about Jeff Bridges. I would also like to mention the Little Shop of Horrors, mm-hmm. where you can buy horrors.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good.
That's not what they sell.
When you need horror, you can get one there.
The store in Gremlins at the beginning. Obviously, yes. It's been bulldozed by the villainous forces of Clamp. That would have been good. Ali, I'm amazed you haven't mentioned High Fidelity. It would take ages to get service.
If you asked for, like, I don't know, NSYNC, you'd be thrown out the window and have your teeth knocked out by a till.
Which is ironic, because who doesn't want NSYNC on vinyl?
Of course.
That's just a classic.
It's difficult to scratch it on your turntable, otherwise. I've tried it with a CD.
In terms of places you want to visit, maybe not really, but I always like the idea of the pawn shop in the Terminator, where Arnie goes and gets served by Dick Miller and then serves Dick Miller with bullets. And you know, hey, you can't do that. Wrong, says Arnie, and then he blows him away. Wrong.
You can do that.
Thanks for clarifying.
The Terminator asshole.
Your Roger Moore is getting better.
It is, do you think? I'm attempting to enter. I'm going to mention Dawn of the Dead again. George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, which has an entire mall of places, you know, mall of shops to choose from. It actually is a real mall. It's the Monroeville Mall out there in Pittsburgh, and I think it's still standing to this day. And they basically would shut it down. They would shoot at night, so the mall would be a mall during the day, and then they would shut down night, and they would race in and quickly redress what they needed to redress and kill all the zombies, then wipe the blood off the walls, and then business would resume again in the morning, and they would try not to break anything. Interestingly enough, there's a gun store in the mall, which is never named, in Dawn of the Dead, but there is no gun store in the mall itself, or there wasn't at the time, so they had to fake it using movie magic.
They must have got that from the movie magic shop. Quickly, I want to mention the chocolate store at the very beginning of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, where they get the golden ticket. I love that shop.
Can I just say that I was going, because you mentioned chocolate and not Willy.
Or Wonka. But no, it's this really old-fashioned chocolate shop, like Sweet Shop, which I love. I want to mention the druggists in It's a Wonderful Life.
Uh-huh.
I know something sad happens there, but I've always liked that old-fashioned American thing where you have the little stools and you get your sodas, but it's also a pharmacist, but also kind of just like a place where you buy chocolate and stuff. And yeah, it's a kind of an Americana thing. I love it there.
It's pretty cool. Just speaking of chocolate, Chocolat, that store is looking pretty incredible.
I think my favourite store, I've just realised, in pop culture in general is the chocolate store. I don't know which episode of Simpsons it is, but it's the one where Homer has a dream and he lives in a land of chocolate. And he runs through the joke where he runs through the land and he's biting bits of chocolate off everything. Then he gets to this chocolate store, it's made entirely of chocolate. And it says 50% off. He basically goes, half-price chocolate. It's one of my favourite jokes. Oh, my God, I love it. Again, we're not being definitive here. This is all off the top of our heads. So if you do have anything you think we've missed out, then do send them in. Let's move on then to this question from at Sean1Neo, who says, if you had a British-only Expendables team, who would you have?
Scott Adkins.
Yes.
Hi, Scott.
Scott Adkins and no one else. He doesn't need anyone else. He can take on the
I'm
bad
calling
guys.
The movie The Expendable. Brackets UK.
We may only have days to pull this off, but I want to see all the Bonds getting together. I say days because Sean Connery may not be British soon.
Oh, God. Thank God. I have no idea where you're going with that.
Oh.
I was like, oh, Jesus, God.
Sorry, I didn't mean to scare anyone.
What a way to announce it.
Yeah, no. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes, it makes sense, yes.
So,
but he'll still be Bond.
Yeah, but he wouldn't be British. It says British only. It's very clear he would be Scottish, which is.
Yeah, but his Bond. I always thought his Bond was.
No, but we're looking
really
for British actors.
British actors.
Yeah.
Oh my God. All right.
And actually, if you don't have the Scottish hard men in the pool for this, that really does narrow the options.
Jerry Butler.
Yep. Out.
Alan Hansen.
Gone.
He's out. Sunes. Gone.
Rapsy Nesbitt.
Rapsy Nesbitt. This is a tough one.
It is tough.
So,
I've got a team.
So we've got Statham in the bag.
Statham's staying.
Asley Christmas?
Yeah.
Or is his brother
Tree Christmas?
Tree Christmas? I like it.
Well, I think all the American Expendables get kidnapped and Lee Christmas has to get on a flight to England and recruit the Britpendables. So he goes straight to Ben Kingsley. Yeah, he doesn't call him sir.
Oh.
And there's a fight. So that's the first action scene.
Okay.
Oh my God. About this.
But it's fine. They shake hands and they go to Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, Anthony Hopkins.
Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
And I've run out of here, so I said Creepy Paddington.
Creepy Paddington.
Ray Winston.
Who's Jonesy! Can do them all.
That's a pretty tough
group
of fellas. Yeah.
Stifey! Right, okay, you gotta you gotta have Big Driss.
No one calls him Big Driss.
You gotta have Big Driss.
I would love you to interview him and call him Big Driss.
To his face.
Dristopher.
From one Driss to another. Ooh. Big Driss. Idris Elba.
That's legitimate. Eccleston, maybe?
No.
What?
No. Oh. Get out.
He's tough. He wore a leather jacket.
He's
Dr. Who.
He's tough. He wore a leather jacket. I've worn a leather jacket.
No, you haven't.
Yeah, I did.
Really?
Yeah.
You could have all the Who's. You could have all the Who's.
Except David Tennant's Scottish. He might not be British soon.
We don't get political here on the Empire Podcast, but please vote no to independence. Please, Scotland, because we don't want to lose you from the Expendables team.
How about Richard Armitage? He's very tall and broad. He could do it.
Richard Armitage. He's very tall and broad. Well, you have to have Luke Evans in there as well, wouldn't you? Because he's from Wales. It's a Welsh accent,
and
isn't it?
It's very close to Anthony Hopkins where he grew up.
Oh, bloody Anthony Hopkins!
What about, I think Andy Serkis would make a good sapper.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Christian Bale, Henry Cavill, all these people are British.
I'm throwing in Sean Harris because he's terrifying.
Yes.
I've not met him, but I'm scared of him. I'm constantly looking over my shoulder.
Yes.
In case he's there.
He's an amazing actor. But
he really is.
He's utterly terrifying in the nicest possible way.
So he could kind of be the Gunnar Jensen of the team.
Yeah.
The slightly frightening one.
That's a great idea. We can't have an Expendables team without our new spirit animal, topless Dan Stevens. He has to be in there and he has to lose his shirt.
I think he could beat off quite a few of his enemies. Just really get in there and just do what needs to be done.
Yep. Absolutely, set about them, have at them, get to grips with them.
He's a hands-on fighter.
He really is. You've got to have Simon Pegg in there for comedy relief, haven't you? And also the man has shown in the past he can handle the action.
He can.
You know, he can do the two guns thing and all sorts.
And Nick Frost was pretty formidable in World's End. So.
All right, so this Expendables team, this British Expendables team, is roughly 17 strong at the moment. And we haven't even mentioned
Daniel
Day-Lewis.
Irish.
Technically speaking.
Oh, I would suggest Jason Fleming.
Yes, I would second that.
J. Flem. This is amazing.
Idris.
D. Fletch.
Sure.
C. Hughes.
D. Lewis. Pump action milkshake.
Pump action milkshake. If you have milkshakes, he will drink them.
If Daniel Day-Lewis were a wrestler for the WWE, I think his move would be dropping the milkshake. Which means taking someone about the head with a bowling pin. Anyway, as you were. That's a separate question. Do someone email in and say, if Hollywood stars were wrestlers, what would they be called and what their special move would be?
Oh, that's a great idea. That's a great question. Yeah, please do that for next week. Let's bring this sorry mess to an end. If you want to send us in any questions, and why would you after that, do please send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. You can use the hashtag Empire Podcast or we won't see it. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine and we are on email. Email, can you believe it? podcast@empireonline.com is the address. Time now for our first interview. George Mackay is a fine young British actor who was nominated this year for the EE Rising Star Award at the BAFTAs, proof that he's come a long way in a short time with fine performances in the likes of For Those in Peril, How We Live Now and Sunshine on Leith. All those films, two of which saw him sport very convincing Scottish accents, were released on the same day last year, which is where I started when he came into the pod booth this week to talk about his excellent new film Pride, in which he plays a young gay man helping to support a miners' strike in Wales with bloody Luke Evans and Anthony Hopkins.
No.
But no? Okay, back in 1984.
You went Jamaican.
I don't know why. Okay. He's Scottish Jamaican. The Welsh accent is so bloody hard to keep up, isn't it?
It's like Locke got very drunk and drove into a tree.
Tom Hardy! How is he not in the British Expendables?
Tom Hardy, we're fools.
Oh. No, don't even.
How can you not put me in the Expendables?
Why is he Welsh?
Here's George Mackay.
We're delighted to be joined in the Empire Pod booth by George Mackay, star of Pride. Fantastic film.
Thank you.
Welcome, sir. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. So it is Mackay, it's not McKay, it's not Mackay, it's nothing like that, but you must get that all the time.
Yeah, it's not too much of an issue. It's Mackay, yeah.
But, okay.
Okay. From the Scottish Mackay.
From the Scottish Mackay, because of course you've been playing Scots now for
quite a while. Yeah, I've been faking Scottish for a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's from Clan Mackay. We've got a tartan and everything.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you wear kilts?
I've worn a kilt in the tartan, yeah.
Okay, and how did that work out for you? Did you go the full Scot?
We went full Scots. Me and myself. That's how Scottish we went.
Fair enough. And the burning question of the day is obviously yes or no?
Yes.
Scottish independence.
Oh, I think... God, here we go about the kind of... We'll probably talk later on about... Because of Pride, I think we should be more political, and I'm umming and ahhing over this. I reckon yes. I reckon national identity is a really positive thing.
You think?
I think so. I don't know enough about the business to... kind of the business side of things to comment on it. But my best mate is very for yes, so I think I should back him up. Because he's got a stronger opinion than I do.
Fair enough. If we can get him in here, we can have an argument going on. That'd be nice. But that'd be good. I'm just annoyed about having to use my passport every time I go to Glasgow. That's indeed what's going to happen. But
if that's all it comes down to, yeah. I think I don't know. I'll try. I've got a fake Scottish passport that I keep anyways. But yeah, I've drawn myself.
And if worst comes to worst, you can always blend in as well. You can rely on the Scottish accent. You can bring it out in times of trouble.
In times of trouble, blend
disappear.
In. Yeah, go incognito in the foreign country. That way, if they go independent, I'll speak a foreign language.
Absolutely.
So, which I don't now.
Absolutely. How tricky are Scottish accents to master?
I didn't find it too, but I had some sessions with a dialect coach before For Those in Peril, which is the first time I did it, and I didn't find it too bad, really. It was one of those ones that kind of, once you got into the rhythm of it, it's kind of very rhythmic, so it was sort of once you're in there, it's grand. So it wasn't too bad, really. I think one thing I didn't realise was how much the Scottish accent changes for such a small country, the various accents within it, you know. Yeah, I was kind of quite naive about that, because I kind of think it's great how in England we've got, you know, London and Scouse and Brummie and, you know, all the different types of accent, or Bristol, you know, where it's the same in Scotland. It's tiny, but you know, you go coast to coast, city to city, and it does change. But no, it wasn't too bad to get a grasp of, and there is some Scots in me way back when. So
have you done the who do you think you are thing? Have you done the family tree, tracing your way yourself all the way back to
William Wallace himself?
As it turns out, I'm a descendant of William Wallace.
Yeah, Mel Gibson's great 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 grandchild. No, I haven't yet, but I should do. I think it'd be interesting. My dad's Australian, so I'd be interested to see kind of where that journey went. And I think, well, there's a bit of Irish in my grandma, so I think it'd be interesting to see how they all got so far away and came back again.
We'll talk about Pride in a second as well, but the last time we spoke was for Empire magazine itself. Mm-hmm. And it was just ahead of what we had dubbed George Mackay Day. George Mackay Day. No, I'm doing it again.
That's all right.
George Mackay Day.
But it's got more of a ring to the day.
It does, doesn't it? George Mackay Day, which was October 4th of last year, when you were in three films that were coming out on the same day.
Yeah.
So it was For Those in Peril, How I Live Now, and Sunshine and Leith. What did you do on that day?
I was working, I think. I was working on Pride, and so I didn't really do too much. I went to work and had a nice day there.
All right,
a nice day on Pride.
So you didn't say, right, okay, guys, now we've wrapped. Who fancies a trip to the cinema? What would you like to watch?
Yeah,
we could go see Me in This or Me in This.
Sat everyone down. No, I didn't do anything.
All right, so it wasn't a game changing day for you. It wasn't a thing that completely transformed your life.
No. That'd be terrible if it was.
Can you imagine? But at that time, I actually hadn't seen Sunshine and Leith. And just talking about the Scottish accent and whatnot, and things that you have to, I guess, things you have to do in Pride as well. But I imagine the most nerve-wracking experience of your life must have been in Sunshine and Leith, at that very, very end, where you do the musical number in front of what seemed like hundreds of extras.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was really exciting. It was very nerve-wracking, but it was, it was really, everyone, there was such a positive vibe. Dexter is so, like, his energy is wonderful. Like, it's really, really infectious, and he sort of sets the bar for everyone of this positive energy and this excitement around set. And he was just, as ever, as Dexter is on that day, and it just kind of, it was lovely as a coming together, because we actually, I think I can say this, yeah, but we went back and redid it. We had a smaller ending, and then they said, no, I think we need this big lift at the end, this kind of payoff. And so it was a kind of coming together, having been away for a little bit as well. So it was just really exciting, and I think everyone had this, and we had two glorious days in, you know, which again, if the weather was perfect, everything was kind of seeming like it was coming together, and it was just, there was such a positive vibe that it was just really exciting to be doing it, really. Of course, it's kind of very nerve-wracking, like singing or kind of, you know, having the song, you know, and your voice played out. But everyone was so kind of supportive and excited to be there and involved that it was, you know, we were just one of the many people that was there. It didn't feel like it was kind of us performing to these people. It just felt like we were one of the 400 people all dancing in the square.
Yeah.
Which we were.
But are you tentative at first when you're in the first take, maybe just not quite giving it your all, a little bit, holding yourself back a little bit, or is it very much right from the off, you're just into it?
I think it's one of those things that through the experience of doing Sunshine and Youth, which was really, really helpful and enlightening, was, it's one of those things that if you don't go for it singing and dancing, it's really bad, unless you're really good, which I'm not. you can't really not go for it completely, because then it's just sort of falls in between,
and it's no good.
So it was kind of a case of, I'm saying all this, and I'm sure the difference between the first and the last take, we would have really been kind of go, because we kind of had it in our, you know, had it in your bones a bit more. And but no, I think everyone just went for it. And watching the other dancers, the dancers were amazing. I remember going over that, you know, it's quite a simple routine, but I was going over it and over it and over it, trying to get it in my head. Where, you know, they, Arthur, the choreographer, would kind of be like, when we did it a couple of days before, would be like, okay, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and all the dancers were like, okay, boom, 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 and I was there like, 2, 3, go back to the beginning a bit. So it was just inspiring watching all of them. And what's great about them is, and the way that they move, is that they, you know, they really go for it every time. So it's like, right, well, if that's, again, it's kind of, that's the bar was set.
You know? And at that time, as you said, the last time we spoke, you were working on Pride, and I don't think it had been announced yet. You were You were telling me how excited you were to be working on this, but really I didn't know that much about the movie. It's a fantastic film. It's great. Obviously about the lesbian and gay support group that supported the miners during the miners' strike back in the 80s when you weren't alive.
No.
So
yeah, that was about a twinkle in the eye.
Absolutely. So how did you go about finding about this stuff? Did you know already? I mean, the miners' strike is something that's legendary. Were you aware of it already, or had you to do a lot of research when this came up?
No, I knew a level of context. But I didn't know the story itself, and that was what was so wonderful and exciting about it, which is, I mean, there's a sadness that it's not been told before. And it's kind of lovely that we get to share it now and, you know, get to be part of it. But it's it was just really wonderful to learn this story and to kind of be inspired by what these people did. And I think what's lovely about it is it's not just a story about the politics of 84 and of gay rights. That's predominantly what it's about, but truly kind of at the heart of it, it's a film about community and about a bond as humans, and that transcending what you know, the troubles that you face, really, and kind of transcending surface level, you know, boundaries that we put out for ourselves, and that we are just people at the end of the day. And that is kind of such a simple message, but that kind of message of kindness is so applicable to everything. And it was really, really lovely to be part of a story that is true and hadn't been told before, and tells it so wonderfully.
It is a true story, and a lot of the characters in the film did exist. Many of them still alive to this day, except your character, Joe.
Yeah.
AKA Bromley.
AKA Bromley.
No Scottish accent in this one.
No. just the Bromley one. I think he was. Joe's fictional, and I think he's an amalgamation of a number of different people's stories. I mean, Stephen did a lot of research, and I think that Joe's purpose within it, though, is what Stephen. Stephen Beresford, who wrote it, and was very present on set all of the time, which was really helpful. And he's an amazing writer and a really wonderful man. So it was just great to have him there all of the time. But I think the reason he put Joe in the story is to kind of give the audience an outsider to go in with, really, because Joe's the only one that enters this story completely outside of a community to begin with. You know, he's not on one side or the other, and he enters into that world and discovers it as we do. And I think it was a really clever storytelling. I don't know what the word is, technique, or it was a really kind of storytelling device to have someone like that, and it was just, and it's wonderful because it gives the character a really special journey as well. And so it was a joy to play.
Yeah, because he starts off very timid within himself, within his own sexuality as well, and then by the end he's fully embraced that side. After well, not to give too much away, but
yeah,
you know, but there is certainly a real growth there for the character.
Yeah, completely. I think it's about someone who, I mean, in Joe's case, who, yeah, isn't comfortable with, I think he knows who he is in himself, but he hasn't accepted it, and therefore he uses his friendship and the political cause and the identity and that kind of movement and what they're doing, and that fight as a kind of shield at first, almost. And that was what was interesting as well. It's not just someone who's like, right, I know who I am. It's that someone who has found something that they can, in a way, kind of hide behind at first. And because that's, you know, without giving too much away, you know, you're out and proud and at these marches and kind of fighting kind of on the front line as a gay man, and then you go home and, you know, you pretend that you're not to your parents, or you know, he's kind of got two acceptances in a way before he fully commits, and, you know, to who he is, and discovers that and is comfortable within that. So it's a really lovely, really lovely journey.
It's a gorgeous movie. It's really heartwarming and fun and moving and profound in many ways. And it's got such a great cast.
Yeah,
I imagine this one was one of those things that, you know, recalls that sort of tired analogy about the tennis game, where, you know, if you're playing tennis against someone who's really, really good, you raise your game. I don't. I get obliterated. But as an actor, What's it like when you're on screen with the likes of Paddy Considine and Bill Nighy? And it must make you step up the plate, I guess.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, it's just wonderful to be around those people who and watch them. They're just kind of all great craftsmen, right? and kind of you can't help but pick up. And no one ever. That was it was lovely as well, because no one sort of rams it kind of down your throat or anything, and it's and you also get to know them. What's a real privilege as well, as you get to know them as as Paddy and Bill and Imelda, and kind of you spend the first day kind of calling everyone by their full name to yourself, and it's kind of no one sat you down and went, well, what I do is, but you just watch these people and kind of learn by osmosis, really, and work. People like Imelda was. She's so what was amazing is I remember one time in particular we were doing a scene where the two groups come together before the ballroom, and it was before the Pits and Perverts ball, and it was at the end of the day and we didn't have much time to shoot the scene, and so they were like, cool, we'll quickly rehearse it, and we all ran together and kind of did lots of hugging and kissing and greeting each other, and she went, oh, hold on, we've got to remember to greet each other as the characters. And it was such a simple thing, but you kind of sometimes forget. You're like, yeah, kind of, I'm wearing the clothes, I'm here, this is the last kind of scene of the day, and you sometimes forget to be the person and to tell the story as it should be told, rather than just kind of people kissing three times on the cheek and kind of like that, as how would I greet, how would Joe greet, and how would Hafina greet people then, it's just kind of little things like that you realise these people through their experience and being so good at what they do, they're just always on point like that, and that was really special to be around. That kind of, it was a constant reminder.
What's next for you?
Coming out, there's hopefully later this year, there's a film that premiered at Venice called Bypass, which is directed by Dwayne Hopkins, which again he's a wonderful director. He did a film, Better Things was his first feature, and I had a really special time working with him, and I'm yet to see the film. But from the experience of working with him and his aesthetic and kind of use of sound and storytelling in Better Things, and the way, what he values as a filmmaker and as a person as well, I'm very excited to see how that does. And sadly, I couldn't be there for the screening at Venice, but it's going to be at the London Film Festival.
Oh, cool.
So there's Bypass, and I've just finished a film called Captain Fantastic with Viggo Mortensen, and that was directed by a director called Matt Ross, who's an American director, and it's a really, really wonderful script that Matt's written, and it was a real, it was a real joy to work with. It was a very young cast for myself. It's about this family who make this journey down the west coast of America, and to work with Viggo was really special, and we've literally just wrapped that, but it was a really wonderful experience, and hopefully that'll be coming out next year. I'm not too sure what the plan is with that.
So it's not a Marvel movie.
No, it's an ironic title. Yeah.
Okay.
There's no superpowers involved per se.
Maybe that all come for you. Who knows?
I don't know. Well, you see, yeah, maybe. I don't know. That'd be grand. Maybe some spandex and some metal armor or something like that.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
I think that would be a good look. I've been working on some costumes, piecing together.
Just sketching some stuff down.
Just sketching. Yeah,
just wearing them around.
Just working different superheroes created. I don't know enough kind of Marvel superheroes myself I've taken it upon myself to create a superhero.
Just do it yourself, the McKinley-verse.
The McKinley, he wears a kilt. He's a superhero and he has a Scottish passport.
Yeah, he's
whether
authentic
he needs it
Scottish.
Or not.
Indeed, George McKay, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. George McKay there, not McKay, as I called him throughout the interview. Sorry about that. Apologies to George. It's one of those weird things where you ask someone before an interview, you go, how do you pronounce your name? Is it McKay or McKay? And he goes, it's McKay. I go, great, please welcome George McKay. Like, what am I doing? Yeah. What am I doing? Anyway, so he's a lovely guy.
How do you pronounce your name, Michael Jackson? It's Michael Jackson. Okay, here's Michael Jackie.
Here's Big Driss. On the turntables.
It's Jack Attack.
I believe that's a DJ name.
Right, movie news?
Yes.
Shall we?
I thought I'd start things off with a break from tradition and we talk about Marvel.
Did you? Oh, Marvel, is it? Okay, fine.
Yep.
Okay.
So.
Better do it then.
Guess that's not a bad idea. I don't know whether anybody wants to stop me. Basically, Robert Downey Jr., right? Famous guy. He's got a beard sometimes. He looks good in a suit. He can get away with wearing shades that are slightly tinted with different colours. I mean, it does remind me of the question I do often want to ask him. And we've thought about asking this to him before, which is, what is he like? I mean, what is he like?
What you like?
Robert Downey Jr., he says that Iron Man 4, and this is a news story, I promise you, is not in the works. Now, this is of note, because Iron Man 3 made big money.
It did.
Also, Avengers made big money, and I'm sure Avengers 2 would make also big money. But it seems that even there were lots and lots of dates that have been plucked out and stamped on and had flags put in them for the Marvel calendar in the upcoming few years, Iron Man 4 is not one of them. I feel like this is a good idea.
Yeah.
And I have reasons. And the reasons are, it's a nice trilogy that works well together. We're yet to see what's going to happen with Avengers 2. And I think it may even just be of a benefit to let that character be for a while and revisit him when, you know, more things have happened in that universe. I also want to see what happens if Chris Pratt's plan for Guardians of the Galaxy 2 has him... his character Iron Man, obviously Tony Stark, get shot on the head point blank whilst he's sitting down reading a book by a swimming pool, because apparently Tony Stark had been hitting on Gamora. So I want to see that happen, maybe in a credit sting that no one sees coming.
This is one of those weird stories that has become a news story this week, even though we kind of already knew it. There were lots of stories getting very excited about the fact that Millennium Falcon will be in Star Wars Episode 7. Well, we already knew that. It tried to kill Han Solo, for God's sake. Kind of weird, but let's take it aside. We know that his contract ran out, Downey Jr.'s contract ran out with Iron Man 3. We know that he signed on for two more movies, and those would be two more Avengers movies. So we know that he hasn't signed on for any more Iron Man movies as Tony Stark. So it's a bit strange. This is coming, I guess, from a direct quote from him. He's been doing interviews for The Judge. So I guess someone asked him and he said, oh, it's not the works. So I guess you can see the spin on it. But this, for me, isn't really music. I guess it's interesting that Marvel aren't following the money, aren't just going, oh, Iron Man 3 broke a billion, so here's Iron Man 4, 5, and 6. That they are not deviating from their plan. And they did the same with the Hulk. When Hulk was amazing in Avengers, they didn't just go, here's a Hulk movie. They've stuck to their guns. And I think fair play to them. More power to their elbow.
Mm. There was a little bit more Marvel news this week, but more for TV. Mm. First came rumours and then came an image, or reports and then an image, that Agent Peggy Carter, played by Hayley Atwell, would be appearing in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Next season. And indeed, the image does show her with some of the Howling Commandos who previously worked with Cap in the first...
Dum-Dum Duggins in the picture. It's great.
Dum-Dum Duggins, great. And Gabe Jones, who is, of course, the grandfather of one of the kind of the new core S.H.I.E.L.D. agents. So we're going to see them. I guess it's going to have to be some kind of flashback or some kind of mini-episode setting up something that S.H.I.E.L.D. then encounters in the modern day in the main series, because, she's not in old-age makeup or anything. Mm. But it does look like that's going to be a nice way to just introduce people who maybe aren't already incredibly excited to the fact that Agent Carter is getting her own series, and it's going to be awesome.
I would love it if they do actually go back in time. That would be awesome. Because there is, and I don't want to spoil the first episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for you, a flying car, which made people set their eyebrows to raise brows when that first came out. But if they're doing that, then why not a bit of the old time travel?
Talk of Captain America recalls the bookstore. The bookstore.
Ah, yes.
The bookstore. You like the bookstore? From the first movie, which is also a bookstore, but then has a big secret underground lab underneath it. So,
speaking
of movie shops we like to visit, also the owner is a machine gun toting badass.
And it brings us back to Richard Armitage being quite terrifying.
Yes. And he is also in the Brit Spendables.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The tying
UK
together,
Spendables?
People.
The UKIP Spendables? No.
No.
No. No. No. Too far edge. Right. Anything else?
Terminator Genesis. Genesis. Yeah, sorry. It's spelt wrong here. It's got a Y in it.
Sorry, I'll change that when we get back downstairs.
Thanks, Alan. Yes. It hasn't arrived yet, but presumably it has come out in the future and they've used time travel to come back and green light Must have been a huge hit, because they've greenlit two more.
Two more badly spelled sequels.
We don't know at this point if they're going to be more typos, but they're coming out and in 2017 and 2018.
How are they spelling sequel, by the way?
It's got a U in it.
Presumably, it's meant to have a U in it. Presumably the next two would be Exodus and Leviticus.
Leviticus and
Exodice.
With four X's.
They're filming back to back, in case you're wondering how they were doing 2017 and 2018. So
that's confident.
It's very confident.
It's very confident.
Or is this just one of those ones where I swear they release new stories? For example, this week it was announced that they found a new writer for 23 Jump Street. And if you've watched 22 Jump Street, they kind of take the mick out of the idea of them being sequelized yet again. They want to, at the end, you know, you have this joke where Ice Cube goes, "You're off to medical school." So that might be funny. But
I would love it if they do run through every single one of those sequels we saw.
Yeah.
And we find out that montage was not a comedy montage.
It's
that
the real.
Was genuine pitches for all of those films.
Channing Tatum gets swapped out by Seth Rogen, 10 episodes in. But I swear that they released this news that they had in their news bag for ages, because it's on iTunes now. You can get 22 Jump Street on iTunes now. So they released this to either, as is the case I think with Terminator Genisys, "By the way, this film still exists, don't forget please, hi," because this is news, just so you're still thinking about it.
It may be. I mean, it is also sometimes helpful to, you know, combat any bad press and reassure people that this is going to be awesome to greenlight a sequel before the film comes out. And of course they did greenlight, if I remember correctly, the sequel to Green Lantern before that came out, and
they
that
did.
Has yet to materialise.
They keep talking
about
it.
We're still waiting, desperately.
I know.
Bring it on. Bring
when
it
will
on.
It happen?
Yeah. I don't know how to... I mean, it's a bit of an unknown quantity, this. I've heard some bad word coming out about, you know, the production running over and them having some troubles. I don't know how much that's true, but there hasn't been a trailer yet, so it's a bit of an unknown quantity.
Well, there's another facet to the story, another side of the story as well, which explains why they're hoping to shoot back-to-back if it goes ahead, and hoping to release two sequels back-to-back. Apparently, the rights to the Terminator franchise referred to James Cameron in 2019.
No matter what?
No matter what.
Even if... Are you kidding? I thought it was that if they carried on, like the Marvel rules, that if you carry on using it...
No. Definitive referred date
of
2019. So basically, they're making hay while the sun shines.
So Avatar 3... could have a Terminator in it.
No, it could.
Is this what we're saying?
Avatar 3 could have a Terminator.
This is happening, guys.
Avatar 6 could have a Terminator in it, if he so desired. But not Avatar 3.
I'm writing up the new story.
But go for it. Go for it. That's, you know, might as well. Might as well say that. But that's my, that's the understanding anyway, that the rights go back to him, and therefore they have to get these Terminator movies made as quickly as possible.
I'm very intrigued by these new Terminator films. I'm just very curious to see what Arnie looks like.
We know he's got grey hair because he tweeted that picture, didn't he, from behind of his Terminator or whatever it is that he's playing. I'm sure he's playing a Terminator.
The Terminators do age. You know, they do get old.
That's interesting. That's an idea that we haven't really explored, I guess.
And it's cool casting. I mean, Clark's Jason and Amelia are both pretty cool, so... I'm interested to see them playing Connors, John, and Sarah.
And there's also this rumour, isn't there, scuttlebutt, that the movie will do a Back to the Future 2 and somehow take place within the events of the first movie. Now, does that mean they're going to reshoot, effectively, scenes from the first movie, but swap out Linda Hamilton and Michael Biehn and put in Jai Courtney and Emilia Clarke as, you know, Kyle Reese and Sarah Connor? Or are they going to incorporate footage from the original movie and just hope that you don't notice they don't look anything like each other? How's it going
to
work?
They have to reshoot it, presumably.
They must reshoot it,
they don't look
it,
anything alike, so...
It's very interesting. But I was thinking about this the other day, because we were talking about how awesome Terminator and Terminator 2 are, and, of course, one of the major reasons for that is because they were both R-rated and they were both no holds barred, and whereas Terminator Salvation and T3, I think T3 was a PG-13. They pulled their punches, and for me that just dilutes the Terminator brand. And you would imagine that these movies will be PG-13 as well, which might be a slight word.
Well, we'll see how it goes.
But you know, every day is Christmas Eve at Empire.
There was also news this week. There's another sort of feed in the drip feed of images from Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice. Which is a better look at the Batmobile. There were some leaked images from the set, and Zack Snyder has responded by releasing a much, much better picture of his own, showing the front of the vehicle much more clearly than we saw it previously. And it is the most, I think, aggressive looking Batmobile maybe yet, just in terms of the front. It has swivel guns on there. It has more fins than the Blue Planet episode where they had all those sharks. Remember, there were a lot of sharks, but okay, there are more fins on the new Batmobile. So it's pretty aggressive looking. And, it, you know, I think people who love the tumbler are going to love it. It does have a tumbleriness to it, and also looks like a bitch to parallel park.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. It's interesting. It looks like someone remembered the Burton Batmobile, the Anton First design Batmobile, and the tumbler.
Yeah.
And then went away on a holiday and kind of forgot what they looked like, but had a vague idea, and then just smooshed them together using Lego. Looks interesting. It looks like the sort of thing you wouldn't mess with.
You definitely wouldn't mess.
Kind of Robocop-y guns at the front.
Mm. I think generally, if you and that car were both going for the same parking space, I think you'd back off and let it in.
I also think you have too big a car.
Well, yeah.
It's too big a car.
I mean, if you're going for the same space.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I wouldn't be even...
I mean, in London, you can't.
No.
There's no... Get a smaller car.
Yeah.
Use the tube.
Absolutely. Oh, I wonder what the tax and insurance on that thing would be as well.
Yeah.
Where does he put his MOT symbol?
But he does have indicators, so that's an encouraging safety sign.
Good. Bat road safety is very, very important. Bat mirror, bat signal, bat maneuver, it's all there. We'll see it in action. We'll see it move, and it'll be awesome.
It'll go broom and kill things.
It will.
I also dread, apparently there might be a prequel coming, but there's no...
Yeah, there's no further word. I think Carl Urban was talking at Chicago Comic Con and said it's a definite possibility, but that they're now talking about a prequel rather than a direct sequel. So it would be more setting up the world of Dread, with Dread leaving Mega City 1 and trekking through the Cursed Earth, which is essentially the radioactive wasteland that makes up most of the planet's surface in the Dread universe. And he'd be looking for the first Chief Judge Fargo, who was the sort of the guy who set up the system of judges. I think Dredd's a clone of Fargo, wasn't he, if I remember my lore correctly? So that would be the setup. I mean, it is something that Alex Garland mentioned a while ago, where he sort of talked about you could do a second film, which is all about the city and the law and where it comes from, and Judge Fargo and the pro-democracy terrorists and Dredd's struggle with the state that he's part of. So it is something he mentioned. He didn't explicitly say prequel at that point, but he did kind of talk about it. And then his plan for a third story at that point was you could bring in this crazy existential force that attacks the city in the form of the Dark Judges, which would, of course, be Judge Death, etc., who are massively popular and who would, you know, 21% of our readers would prefer to see him immediately. But 72% are quite on board for this one. So, sounds like a plan. But there's obviously no word yet on anything approaching a green light or a start production or anything else.
So the Kickstarter starts farting now.
Adam Sandler movie coming 2017.
I would genuinely watch a movie. I'd watch Kickpuncher, but then I'd like to see Kickpuncher 2, Kickfarter.
Kickfarter is my new favourite film.
Yeah.
That would be truly amazing. We will round off this week's movie news with the very, very sad news that Richard Kiel, the actor who played Jaws, one of the greatest Bond villains of all time, passed away the night before we recorded this podcast. He was 74 years old. Nick, as someone who, like me, sat through every Bond movie in a row, what's your take on Richard Kiel?
Amazing. Best henchman ever, I'd say. He first appeared in The Spy Who Loved Me. And then he popped back by popular demand in Moonraker. Mm. And I don't know, he's just one of those amazing, iconic movie characters. That skydiving scene I had to watch this morning where he's pursuing him, and he was just completely unkillable on screen, but you just grew to love this guy. And he got his own love interest, which was very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know, just one of the real highlights of the Roger Moore years for me.
It was interesting how they changed his character, how he was truly evil and a nasty bastard in The Spy Who Loved Me, and then effectively became comic relief, I guess, in Moonraker, but great comic relief, and then You know, as you say, got his own love interest and became Bond's ally at the end of that movie as well. And I read today that there were actually plans at one point to bring him back in For Your Eyes Only, where he would marry Dolly, the lady he hooks up with at the end of Moonraker, because they do survive. You think at the end of Moonraker that they're going to die, but they do survive. And that they would have been married, and that you know, that would have been interesting. But then they went in a more serious direction before Your Eyes Only, so they decided to bring it back.
It opens with him walking up to his ex-wife's gravestone, and I mean, as well as, you know, throwing somebody who looks a lot like a bald villain down what looks like a very big chimney. Yeah, I actually thought he was genuinely, when I first watched it as a young child, I thought he was genuinely quite frightening.
Did you think his teeth were real? Because I used to.
Yeah, I guess I would have. There's no reason why I wouldn't have.
Yeah,
I just remember finding him very frightening. It's his hands, massive hands. There's a great photograph of Phil, the other brother to Semlin, who actually met him a couple of years ago. And he used to always pose for his photos. Very amenable guy. By taking his gigantic hands and just clamping them around his foes / new best friend's heads. So there's a great photograph, if you check out Phil's Twitter feed, it's also on our Twitter feed, of him crushing his head, as Phil puts it, into the size of a Jaffa cake.
He's amazing. He was a Terminator before the Terminator, and it's one of those things, like, you look at a Bond film, and I know, Helen, you're not pitching in this because, you know, you're...
I remember him. I mean, I can't remember one Bond film from the next because they all blur into one besuited mess. But I do remember him. He absolutely stood out as a bad guy and then as a slightly better guy.
But what he was interesting about Jaws as well was that there was a real sense of menace from him. There was a real sense that he could actually do harm to Bond, and he could actually even kill Bond, especially in The Spy Who Loved Me. And, you know, truly iconic bad guy, and one of the bad guys I always used to play with on GoldenEye on the N64, but then I realised that you were better off playing with
Oddjob
because he was smaller.
He was smaller, he does less to hit.
Yeah. The sad news about Richard Kiel actually does bring us to our second guest this week. He is the man who fought, vanquished, and then befriended Jaws, as we've heard, over the course of two Bond movies in the 1970s. He's the legend, the icon, who is Sir Roger Moore. He's making his second appearance on the Empire podcast to talk about his new book, the poignantly titled Last Man Standing, which is a raucous collection of celebrity anecdotes. But Bond isn't really mentioned in the book. It's about Moore's other films, about the rest of his career. And so Nick and I took our cue from that and talked to Sir Roger about everything but 007 in a London hotel room recently. Enjoy. We are delighted to have back on the Empire podcast Roger Moore.
Why?
Well,
why are you delighted?
Because you are a legend, sir.
A legend of what?
Well, of the screen.
Legend, yes. Legend is actually spelled leg end. I'm a leg end.
You are a leg end. And not just of the screen, now of the printed page as well, because you're back with a new book, Last Man Standing, which is fantastic. Nick and I loved it. It's hilarious.
Thank you.
It's a compendium of anecdotes, not all of which you were present for.
No.
Which is very interesting. It's quite a risque book.
Really?
I would say so.
Well, the title they thought that I wanted to call it, they thought was too risque in England to go on bookshelves. But they're very happy in America to use it,
okay.
Which is One Lucky Bastard.
Nothing wrong with that.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, there are a lot of bastards in England, including me. They said no, on the shelves it would not be accepted.
Could they not just put an asterisk in the word bastard, or perhaps put a little sign over the...
What
over
else
the book?
Could you do with B .. the
Bizarre.
Buggered.
One Lucky Buggered.
One Lucky Buggered.
That's a sequel.
But you've crossed paths, Roger, with so many amazing people, and the Frank Sinatra stories in the book are fantastic. But there's this amazing picture in the book of you with Peter Sellers, and he's trying to paint your toenails at Cubby Broccoli's house. Can you give us any more context for that picture? Because it's just kind of there, and it's brilliant.
Well, Lord Lindley took it.
Really?
Snowden, yes.
He took the photo?
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.
He and Peter Sellers, they came up to Cubby's house, clowning around. Peter was taking pictures. And
was that the sort of person Sellers was? He would just erupt and just anything for jokes?
He was on with an audience.
Yeah. Were you and he great friends, in a way, Peter Sellers? Because you appeared... this is one of the things I've always wanted to know about you. You appeared at the end of Curse of the Pink Panther.
Yeah.
For a few seconds as Inspector Clouseau.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask
one of
about,
my best performances.
Amazing. I wanted to ask about that. Was that in a way something you wanted to do for your friend Peter?
Well, no, I did it for money. Blake Edwards and Julie Andrews are neighbours. We live in the same village, or we did in Switzerland, in Stadt. And it was rather embarrassing for me in a way, because Lynn Frederick, the last Mrs. Sellers, was a friend, and also Miranda Quarry, a wife before. And I remember that, you know, they would be upset if, I mean, Lynn Frederick saying you wouldn't like anything about Peter, you know. She turned down various offers that were made for using pieces of it. And so I was highly embarrassed when Blake Edwards came to me and said, would I do this? I realized, you know, that Blake knew Peter better than anybody, really. So in the end, it was not done in any way as a tribute, or I think it was just, and apart from that, there was offered quite a lot of money, which is a key factor.
I can't imagine that would be.
And I thought, well, yes, this is, I read the script and it's practically on every page. And I thought, well, it must be at least 2 weeks' work. There's got to be 14 days of that amount of money a day. What happened was we shot it all in one day, started at 7:30 in the morning and finished 10:30 at night. I was absolutely knackered, and they kept cutting bits of it, so we have to go on.
Oh my God. Did you get all the cash in the end? Did you get that?
No, I just got one day's pay.
It
was X amount a day, and I thought, well, it's going to be a lot of money.
Amazing.
But I had a great fun doing it. Joe Lumley was absolutely lovely, and it was enjoyable working with Blake.
One of the interesting things about that performance is that you were credited as Turk Thrust.
The second.
Where did that come from?
Because my friend Brian Forbes, who was in another of the Peter Sellers films, when Peter Sellers was in a nudist colony. And Brian took a credit as Turk Thrust. So I thought I'll be Turk Thrust the second.
Michael Caine has quite a big presence in your book. He keeps popping up. I recently saw Bullseye for the first time, which apparently the two of you have both said it was your Ishtar.
Yeah, Michael said that.
Right. Do you agree?
Rush is our Ishtar.
Do you agree with that?
Well, no, nobody saw it. There was not the build-up to that being exposed for public gaze that there was for the original Ishtar with two gigantic Hollywood stars.
Ishtar does not have a haggis bomb.
But we had a lot of laughs doing it, and I think I got rather fat, because Winner always found wonderful restaurants. He wouldn't have the location catering. That was all right for the crew, but for he and the stars, it was...
On the subject of Michael Caine, you're mentioned in his book, which I'm not sure whether you've read his autobiography, but he tells a story in it of you ringing him in a nervous state just before you were knighted, asking for his advice. I wanted to hear that from your point of view.
I think the nightmare I had when I was told, and you can't tell anybody except your wife, you can't even tell your children, because you're not supposed to announce it. And the nightmare I had was how do I, with my rotten knees, I started practicing kneeling. And Michael said, don't worry, Rich, there'll be a rail that you can get hold of, which fortunately there was.
Okay, that's good.
But I actually don't remember much of it, except I know I'm a coward.
Yes.
And I shut my eyes when the sword was being lowered. Yes.
Well, usually at that point, that's when the stuntman comes in and does that.
No, but years before, I was actually hoping that Prince of Wales would actually perform, because he told me at Brian Forbes' house one night that he'd just done his first investiture, and that his mother and grandmother and showed him what to do. He said, because you have to lift it, because if you go like that, you cut their heads off. And I thought it would be wonderful if he was doing it like I said, don't cut my head off. But I couldn't say that to the Queen.
No, what a way to go, though. A way to go.
Yeah, that would get publicity, wouldn't it?
It certainly would.
How to get ahead.
Like I said, the book is an incredible compendium of anecdotes. Now, as it's nearing publication, is there anything that you left out? Anything that you're suddenly remembering that you'd like to put back in?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that are left out deliberately because people are still alive.
I was wondering if there's a Michael Caine story. What is the Michael Caine story that you would tell if you were comparing a dinner in his honour? He's not at the window.
The knockers are in. My first meeting with Mike, I'd seen him in two plays written by Johnny Spate on BBC. One was called Playmates, and the compartment or something he was on a train. And he was absolutely marvellous. He impressed me a great deal. And I happened to be in Piccadilly, walking outside the then London Pavilion, and I saw he and Terence Stamp coming towards me. And I said, you're Michael Caine. And he apparently had said to Terry Stamp, "Cool, it's fucking Roger Moore." Oh. And I stopped him and I said, "You're going to be a big star." Because I say that to all of them. And then they'll remember me and give me a job. But not Bullseye.
Bullseye too.
One of my favourite parts of the book is your story about the new Star Wars film. Mm. Apparently the kitchen at Pinewood was off limits. Can you tell us the story?
Well, because the suite of offices that Star Wars were taking up closed off access to our toilet, where we could, wash our cups and sort of fill our teapots, amongst other things. And that was sort of closed off access to that because Star Wars was being prepared in great secrecy. And it meant a long, long walk down to the Herbert's bathroom.
Yes. It was
too much. And so I'd worked for J.J. Abrams in Alias, or Elias, I don't know what it's called, in Hollywood. So I wrote to him, and of course he opened up the doors.
Amazing.
So did you?
I promised not to look at the steel script.
Did you have to get a pass then, a Star Wars pass?
No, it was all...
It was all underhand, okay. Do you now know the full story of Star Wars?
I know what's going to happen. I knew that Harrison Ford was going to break his leg.
You had inside information.
Oh, yeah, we arranged it. It's good insurance money. They used to do that to me on Bond. I always reckoned that I would get badly injured, so they'd get the insurance money, and I wouldn't even be able to come back.
There we go, the conspiracy
unveiled.
They could
recast it with an actor who's even cheaper than me.
So you were still at Pinewood quite a bit. You still go down there and
yes,
have an office?
The oldest resident.
And can you walk around and peek your head into anything you like? Can you open up the doors and see what's going on?
I wouldn't dream of doing that. I never open doors.
The Bond stage, I imagine, the 007 stage, must be your playground. You must be able to walk on there.
Well, it's been changed since I think it was, I know Harold Wilson came to open it and I was sick. I'd had shingles and felt like death.
Right.
I had to go there for the opening, the 007 stage. Cubby was very proud of that. And then, of course, it burnt down and rebuilt. But Ken Adams did the most magnificent set when we built it for Spy Who Loved Me, with the submarines inside the ship.
Oh, yes. The cover of the book is very interesting because... you chose not to just use a picture of yourself. It's an on-set picture of you and Gregory Peck and David Niven and Trevor Howard. Why did you decide to use that shot?
Because I'm going to name drop in the book, and they're all part of the book.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of happy memories with that film. And I remember it was my brilliant idea to have those chairs with everybody else in the wrong chair, everybody sitting in their wrong chair.
I imagine that you haven't been anywhere for a very long time and not been recognised, but you do tell a story in the book of going to renew your passport. And there's this very funny story of meeting this Jobsworth.
But it's typical home office, yes. Or the treatment of people, you know, who they'll allow you. And then finally sort of saying, can I have your autograph? And so, you know, you get strip searched almost at airports, and they take your shoes off and your belt and your jacket, and you say, God, I use deodorant today. Mm. Well, and I, because I have a pacemaker, I have to go, I'd never go through the thing.
Oh, really?
I have to go around and be searched even further.
Yes.
They know if I've got hairs, where you ask me. And they know what I've got in my pocket, because they fold in my pocket. And at the end of all that, they say, can we have a picture?
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's so funny.
Well, what do you say?
I say, no, of course you can't.
Let me search you, then maybe I'll take a picture. There's some interesting facts about you, Roger, on the internet. I just wanted to run through a couple to see whether they're true or not. It's a thing we do occasionally.
I'm alive.
You're alive. That's good. That was number one. Number two is, apparently you were Air France's 8 millionth passenger. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I wasn't really, but they said I was. So that I would go to stay at Rules. In Nice, have a week's holiday, ride a caravel, I think it was, the plane.
Amazing. Then it was
anything but Ryanair.
Precisely. There's but another amazing
pay to go to the toilet.
I cannot imagine you on Ryanair.
Standing,
Roger, so Roger Moore
standing
on Ryanair.
Room only.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's true.
Have they really got those? You don't sit down, you stand, you have a leaning board.
I think they talked about it. I don't think they've quite gone there yet.
It's only
yet.
A matter of time.
Yeah. They'll strap you to the wings.
But I
like
the idea of paying to go to the bathroom.
It's great. Well, you know, short flights, hold it in, it's all good. There's
can you imagine Gérard Depardieu?
There's an amazing tidbit here. You were made a captain in the police by the captain of the Maine State Police Force, and you retained the power to arrest.
Yep.
Is this true?
Yeah, but I don't have my warrant card anymore, and I've lost my badge. I don't know where all those things go.
You're a maverick. You've no longer got a badge, no longer got a gun.
No, that's it. I was maverick.
That's true. Got 48 hours to crack the case. Hates being wet when acting.
Hate being wet.
When acting. Is this true?
Probably, because I have been on sets where there's a lot of water around, and I'm always worried about all the cables and wires running through the water. But I've never discussed that with anybody.
And there it is, as fact on the internet.
You do say in the book that you Googled yourself at one point.
I did, and apparently, I must have done it a lot last week, because a friend of mine in Monaco emailed me today and said, I was 70, whatever it is, Google tweets, or not Google tweets, it's Google something. Google search.
Or hits.
That people, there's been a 79% increase.
I actually went on Google just before this interview, and if you type in Roger Moore, it sort of autofills, it puts words that people have been searching for with your name. And the three of them that came up were Roger Moore puns, Roger Moore knitwear, and Roger Moore Rolex. I was wondering if you're happy with the
bollocks.
Rolex.
Oh, Rolex. Thank you very much.
Does that surprise you? Or
Roger Moore
knitwear.
That's Michael Caine's favourite. He calls me the big knit because I did knitting patterns when I was hard up, struggling young actor.
Really?
The big knit.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, people. Okay, even on Dame Edna. He produced a knitting pattern. I joke about it, say, I'm known as drop one pearl, one drop one plane.
When was the last time you wore knitwear?
I have a woolen jockstrap. You mean the hand knitted something?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
A long time.
strange ladies that knit things for me.
Really? Do you get given a lot of gifts when you're going on a tour with a new book?
A gift is applause.
Is that your favourite gift?
More.
Right. Do you have any more books in the future? Anything you would like to
if
write?
I live long enough, I will.
Because you've written about Bond now, and a couple of books on Bond, and this is a non-Bond book.
This is non-Bond.
Yeah, yeah. There's a very deliberate choice not to. He's mentioned a couple of times, but there's no real Bond stories.
I've said about all there is to say about Bond. Can't keep going on living on there. Maybe I'll write a book about the Saint.
That would be interesting.
Or Ivanhoe. Oh, yeah. I occasionally meet people old enough to remember Ivanhoe.
I want a Bullseye book.
There was one scene I liked in Bullseye where I was the blind piano tuner. Yes. I see it comes to your mind immediately.
I did. I saw it last weekend.
A lovely moment when an actress said, when Michael Winner's shot, master shot, close up of Michael, close up of me. And then the actress said, what about my close up? He said, one more word out of you, darling. I'll cut you out of this film like, bah, nobody would know you were there.
That's a great threat.
You just sipped up and on you went.
That was it.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, we shall let you go. Roger, it has been an absolute pleasure. Best of luck with the book, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
See you next time. And a reminder that Sir Roger's first appearance in the pod was a special in which we talked about pretty much nothing but his Bond days. So if you want to check that out, it is available. Search for more or the date, November 2nd, 2012. And do check it out. It's very, very fun. Okay, let's talk about the week's new releases now. Let's start with the film of the week, which is Pride, Matthew Warkus's tale of how a group of politically active gays and lesbians threw their weight behind the miners' strike in 1984 with astonishing consequences. Got a cracking cast, including Paddy Considine, Imelda Staunton, Bill Nighy, Ben Schnetzer, and of course George MacKay.
Well done,
MacKay. I love this film, Helen.
I loved it a lot. So this is, I mean, it's a story that genuinely does sound A, like it's going to be right on and preachy, and B, like it couldn't possibly have happened. Well, it isn't preachy, probably is right on, but it definitely did happen. So it was basically at a London Pride march, Mark, who's played by Ben Schnetzer, who actually came from Portrush near me, was inspired
Mark,
to...
Mark came from Portrush?
Yeah.
Mark Ashton.
Mark Ashton, the character.
Because Ben Schnetzer is...
is American and has a flawless Northern Irish accent.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're getting slightly off topic.
Moving on.
Basically, Mark Ashton was inspired to do something to support someone else. He realised that there were fewer police than normal at the Pride March that year because they were all off dealing with the miners. They'd been bussed up to the north of England and to Wales to deal with picketing miners. And he thought, sort of, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and started a campaign for lesbians and gays to support the miners. LGSM, it became known as, and they started raising money, and it became quite difficult to find a mining group, you know, very conservative communities who would actually accept this money from them. So they ended up making contact with a very small village in Wales and formed this amazing sort of relationship with them. Matthew Warchus, the director, who's a very, very accomplished stage director, he created Matilda the musical, which is incredible. He did the Lord of the Rings musical. He's done loads of really serious plays as well. He's taking over the Old Vic from Kevin Spacey. He talks about this being a rom-com between two groups, and it kind of is, and I think it works brilliantly well in those terms, because it really, you fall in love with both groups even as they're sort of falling in love with each other. And I think, you know, the individual performances, but also the balance of the collective is just incredibly well done. And it's so funny and so charming that you can get away with the political stuff, that it doesn't feel heavy at all, that it doesn't feel preachy really at all, despite dealing with some really big issues, despite actually being very, very political, I would say with a small p personally, but then it appeals to my pinko lefty politics. It's I just thought it was absolutely wonderful. I went in with very low expectations, despite Phil raving about it to me, and I came out completely charmed.
So is this one to drag your granny to?
Yes, actually, I think it probably is.
Yeah.
I've been recommending it to everyone.
It's a charming, heartwarming film that features Imelda Staunton waving a dildo, which is something I didn't think I'd see. I searched long and hard through the deleted scenes from Harry Potter,
couldn't find anything. This really helped me. It's really, really great. Great performances. The cast are fantastic. Ben Schnetzer, who I think is the closest thing the film has to a lead.
Probably, yeah.
Probably. It's a true ensemble. It's really clever, really well-written script by Stephen Beresford, who I was reading this week, pitched the story to the producer, David Livingstone, and basically said, no one's going to make this movie. No one's ever going to make this movie. It's an incredible story that I've been wanting to write for ages, but no one's going to make it. But I think it shows how far filmmaking has come, and I think it shows how far attitudes towards homosexuality in cinema have really progressed over the last, since 1984, in fact, that you can make this movie and make it seem mainstream and have actors who years ago would have been dubbed brave for playing gay characters attacking these roles with humour and warmth. And it's a great crowd pleaser. I don't know whether it's going to be as big as a Full Monty or something like that, but for me it's a much better film than Full Monty.
It absolutely deserves to be, and genuinely full credit to Stephen Beresford's script is terrific. I mean, there's not a false note in there. It's absolutely wonderful, and the direction as well, Matthew Ward. I just think he gets, it's such a difficult story to get the balance right and make us care about all of these disparate characters, and I think he absolutely succeeds in that. I'm just so impressed by it. We do have an interview, by the way, with the writer and director on the site, and we also talked to Bill Nye about his character, and he's another guy who just breaks your heart in this film. Very, very shy, reserved Welsh minor, but just a wonderful performance from him as well.
Yeah, and I think everyone's great, and Imelda Staunton's just a blast in this film. Paddy Considine, who is very much the sort of the conscience of the miners, he's the one who first meets the LGSM and takes him completely at face value. He walks in with no prejudices whatsoever, and really sets the tone, I think, for the miners. There is opposition when they get to Wales, but it doesn't always pan out the way you think it's going to pan out, as I guess life doesn't as well. It's great. And if you want to read more about the story, obviously there's stuff on our website as well, but there's a great Guardian piece as well where they actually talked to some of the people who are still alive these days, because it is a true story and a lot of the characters in it are real people.
So in summary, what you're saying is there were no real leads but lots of good minor roles.
Indeed. It's my picket of the week. My picket of the week. It's a really striking film. Four stars for Pride. It's really great. It's really great. Go and see it.
Right.
Next up is The Box Trolls, the latest slice of grotesque fun from Leica Studios, the American stop-motion powerhouse behind Coraline and Paranorman. Who wants to tackle The Box Trolls?
So The Box Trolls is, as you say, the new one from Leica, and we've come to expect a certain look and a style from them. I think Coraline we're going to look back on as their prettiest film. They seem to be delving into really grotesque and weird-looking characters. And by that, I mean the humans in this, never mind the box trolls. So the story concerns the town of Cheesebridge, a town where it's ruled by a sort of tiny group, an oligarchy, if you will, and they're obsessed with cheese and spend all their time talking about cheese and tasting cheese and all their money buying more cheese. The town is also plagued by these box trolls who basically run around at night and they pick up rubbish, essentially.
Mm.
And take it back to their underground lair. But years before, they took a small child down to their underground lair, and now there was obviously a scandal as a result, and an exterminator was called in, and he has been promised that he can join these cheese-loving oligarchs at the top of the social tree if he can find and capture all of the box trolls. He's so close to his goal. When we join the story, really, he's you know, decimated their numbers. He's reduced them to a shadow of their former selves. Mm. Now, Eggs, who is the boy that the box trolls stole, voiced by Isaac Hempstead Wright, mm-hmm. from Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. has now grown up. He's working with them. And it turns out that they've been somewhat maligned, that they are actually mechanical geniuses working away on their own little projects, dancing to music and generally eating grubs to survive.
Like us.
and they're actually really quite charming. So it's basically the story of how Eggs and the daughter of the town leader, who's voiced by Elle Fanning, basically try and bring some kind of peace and understanding to this rather bizarre world.
Mm. And it's fun.
It is fun. It's a lot of fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a weird one because it's actually been getting a bit of a kicking critically, I think, in the States most of all. But I found it really charming, really grotesquely charming. I think Leica have ploughed their own little furrow. They do stop motion, but they're not Aardman, and they don't have the same interests as Aardman. They're a bit darker. They're that creepy kid who stays up in his room and plays loud heavy metal music. They're that, essentially.
They are. And genuinely what struck me about this is the box trolls, once you get used to them, are quite cute and quite lovable. But the human adults are just grotesque. They really are horrible looking. And I think maybe that's one of the things that the Americans find quite hard to swallow, because it is quite jarring to see animation this kind of out there and this kind of weird looking, when if you're used to the much smoother and prettier people of the big studios. But yeah, it is a lot of fun. Great voice cast. You've got Sir Ben Kingsley in there, Jared Harris, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, loads of great people. But it's really the animation which is beautiful and stunning in this case. And we gave it 4 stars.
We did give it 4 stars indeed. It is good. It keeps up Laika's run. And then there's The Most Wanted Man, which is one of the films along with God's Pocket, which came out last month, and The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Parts 1 and 2, which will be out later in the year and again next year, will give us our final glimpse at the genius of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Ali?
Yes, a little bit of background about this one. It is based on a John le Carré novel, a relatively recent novel actually, and it is about a contempory world where a jaded spymaster, surprise, surprise, here played by the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman, is dealing with a destitute Islamic immigrant played by Mehdi Debi, who suddenly appears in Hamburg and has the key, I'll say just this, to a large amount of money, and he becomes a part of this big power play between both this German spy, played by Hoffman, a banker, played by Willem Dafoe, and an idealistic lawyer, played by Rachel McAdams. So all great names, particularly Seymour Hoffman. It's very much his show. It's his movie. He's in charge of it. And where the novel actually centered more on the relationship between Dafoe and McAdams, this lawyer-banker romance, there's more romance to it. This is more Smiley-esque. And it's directed by Anton Corbijn. This, like The American, does suffer from being a little too artsy, isn't quite right, but it's a little too cold and doesn't really concentrate on getting the plot ticking along and keeping you engaged with all of the glorious shots of an Icelandic, Nordic type Northern Europe feeling. It's very, very nice to look at, very crisp. You're not really feeling the impetus to find out what's going to come next, and by the end of it, everything kind of seems inevitable, what's going to happen. That said, Philip Seymour Hoffman, again, another great surprise, is excellent in this. He sucks down these cigarettes as well as these tumblers of whiskey that he's always got in his hands. And it's good to see another solid role from him, but the movie itself doesn't quite live up to what should be a great thing. Le Carré, Hoffman, you know, Dafoe, Corbin's got so much potential, but just
looks gorgeous.
Yeah. You know, an exciting trailer that I've been enjoying when I've been watching movies recently, but it doesn't quite work. Maybe Mockingjay will do better.
But if you are a completist, or if you know, worship at the feet of Hoffman, then
or
go
Le
see.
Carré, obviously.
Or Le Carré, go and see. 3 stars we give that, which, as we always say on the podcast, is a recommendation.
So
there we go. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined a week later than originally advertised by virtually the entire cast of The Riot Club. Yes, Max Irons, Douglas Booth, Sam Claflin, Holiday Granger, Jessica Brown Findlay, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn, Brad Dexter, and of course, Horst Buchholz will all be here. And the living legend, the man mountain, that is Liam Neeson, will also be dropping by to keep us up to date with his particular set of skills as he talks about A Walk Among the Tombstones. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Bye-bye.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Bye-bye.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to bloody Wales to perfect my accent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wales, though.
The one that's to the left of England, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. See you next week. Bye.
Bingley bang.